Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The coffin is closed, so the family doesn't have the opportunity to say goodbye.
COVID catastrophe in Brazil. I speak to the ousted health minister, Luiz Henrique Mandetta, about the crisis of leadership and the relentless human cost. Then. Ten years since the devastating Syria war started, I speak to two powerful storytellers who refuse to let us look away. Filmmakers Gianfranco Rossi and Wad Al-Khatib join me. And
over the last year, we have had to build a lot of software to help with the pandemic.
Getting the vaccines into arms, Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff tells our Hari Srinivasan about the critical role of technology. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. More people have lost their lives to COVID in the United States than anywhere else in the world. But it now seems to be on the road to recovery due to President Biden's American Rescue Plan, including getting a firm grip on the vaccine rollout. The same here in the UK and in Israel. But in South America, President Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil could do with taking a page out of those playbooks as his country faces total calamity. Second only to the United States, Brazil's death toll stands at over 275,000, and it's now entering the deadliest chapter in this crisis. Nearly all ICUs in the country are at peak capacity, meaning people aren't getting the life-saving care they need. Some communities are even forced to dig mass graves for the dead. In a moment, I will ask the former health minister what went so badly wrong. But first, correspondent Matt Rivers has this report from São Paulo.
Pamela Ravipi can only look at the photos of her grandmother. She says watching the videos is too painful. The world didn't deserve my grandma, she says. She was too good. Admitted March 3rd with COVID at this small hospital outside Sao Paulo, she died just 2 days later. The facility quickly overrun by a new wave of COVID-19.
A gente pensa naquela família que tá sofrendo.
This doctor who works there says we think about the families that are suffering and we can't sleep. It is unbelievable.
This hospital just doesn't have the facilities to care for those who are really sick. Those patients would usually get transferred somewhere else, but right now there's nowhere else to go. So instead of getting transferred, they're dying.
In just 5 days last week, 12 patients died waiting for an open bed somewhere else, according to hospital officials. Pamela's grandmother was one of them. She thinks that she would have survived if treated in an ICU. But right now, access to those facilities is nearly impossible. Albert Einstein Hospital is one of Brazil's best, but here too, the rooms are full. They are scrambling to build more ICU beds because the patients just keep coming.
It's the most busy time we have ever been in this last year.
We first saw hints of this about 6 weeks ago when we reported from Manaus, a city in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. Hospitals there were overwhelmed amidst a new outbreak, and the city was forced to build so-called vertical graves. And from then to now, that chaos has spread nationwide. In 22 of 26 Brazilian states, ICU capacity is at or above 80%, government data shows. In Sao Paulo, it's 90% and climbing. And when you run out of beds, doctors tell us, people die.
The coffin is closed. So the family doesn't have the opportunity to say goodbye.
The number of such coffins is surging at the Sao Paulo Public Cemetery. From above, you can see the thousands of newly dug graves.
The number of burials, like the one going on behind me, have been staggering recently. Since the pandemic began, the three single days where Sao Paulo has recorded the most coronavirus deaths have come in just the last week.
Experts say the causes of the new surge are myriad: a more transmissible variant, few vaccines, relaxed lockdowns, and government mismanagement, all playing varying roles. But no matter the cause, these are the effects. Outside this public hospital, every day between 3 and 5 p.m., family members of COVID patients inside wait to hear their names.
Jose de Lima.
They go in to get news on conditions. And often, it's not good. And then comes the grief and the tears wrought from a pandemic that just won't end.
Matt Rivers reporting there. Now, while thousands of families grieve for their loved ones, President Jair Bolsonaro has consistently played down the threat of this virus. Luiz Henrique Mandetta, a doctor himself, was the country's health minister until he was fired by Bolsonaro at the height of the first wave last year. We spoke to him then, and he's joining me again now from São Paulo. Welcome back to the program, Minister Mandetta. You have said that in Brazil, more health workers have died than anywhere else in the world under this COVID crisis, that your people are spent, and that this is a result of mistaken political decisions. That's your quote. What do you mean by that? What could have made a difference?
Well, Christian, thanks for having me here. Unfortunately, in such a bad moment, such a sad moment for Brazilian families and for the whole world. Well, the president took the steps one by one, doing what shouldn't be done. He first started telling people that it was just a simple flu. Then he kept on holding his chloroquine box and telling people that that would work. Then he went further and changed. One minister was me, then the other minister. Then he put a military in there. And the general that went in office, he just didn't have the credibility. So he decided not to give the numbers anymore. The Supreme Court had to do it, and the press started to make the numbers because they had no credibility to release the numbers anymore. Then the worst part of it is by August, July and August, all the labs, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson, they all came to Brazil because Brazil is such a good place for vaccines. It's one of the best world-known health systems for delivering the vaccines. So they all wanted to start from here because we can vaccinate many people in one day. But he just said that he didn't want it because he decided to go in a political rally with the governor of São Paulo. So the tests, they just didn't use it, and they all lost their time to be used. And always complaining and blaming someone for the faults and saying that it was almost over. Now we have the worst time till now. Things are hard and are getting worse, and we are going to have many, many difficult days ahead.
I mean, it really does sound catastrophic. Let me just ask you about the vaccines, because as you say, the president did not order all these vaccines that he should have done. But there was the China vaccine, and then the country decided not to use it anymore. Why was that?
No, the country is using it. You have the state of São Paulo, and this was the political, the federal government decided to buy and make the agreements with Fiocruz from Rio de Janeiro with AstraZeneca, and they made this agreement. And the state of São Paulo made an agreement with China for CoronaVac. The problem is that the AstraZeneca is now ready in Brazil. The plant is almost there to deliver it. So the only vaccine we have is CoronaVac made by the Butantan Institute in São Paulo. And it is not enough. So although we have a Ferrari to deliver the vaccines, we just don't have the vaccines to be delivered. So we are going very slow in vaccination. And the virus is everywhere. So everybody's worried about new variants, about what can happen with such a biological lottery that we are watching here. But we have, up to now, just one vaccine, is the CoronaVac. And we are watching the world, the whole, the leaders from Europe and the United States and Canada, they're all buying 4, 5, 6 times the number of vaccines that they need. And we really need it. So it's an international failure also.
So talk to me about the leadership, because that's essentially what it boils down to. And now we hear that this health minister, who you've just been mentioning, a general with no medical experience whatsoever, the latest is he has put out a call from various governors around Brazil calling for a sort of a nationally coordinated response. Is there time, or is it too late to do that? What do you think needs to happen right now to reverse or stop some of this terrible hemorrhaging?
Well, our system, it's a three-leg animal. So we have the federal government, the states, and the cities that sit together in one table. And so when they move together, it really goes fast. But the federal government just went out of the system. So we are counting only with the health systems from the states and the cities. So it's not coordinated. And to restart the game, you would need to have a different behavior from the federal government, starting with the president, giving the example and saying what science tells us to do. He should wash his hands, should use masks, should keep distance, and not call the people to go on manifestations as we had yesterday. But this Minister of Health today, we started the day with the news that the president is going to fire him during today or tomorrow. And he's now trying to find someone that has some credibility. But the physicians that have credibility, they don't want to go to be the Minister of Health, because they know that it's just a matter of time. Then they'll come another and another and another. He has to change the way that he's dealing with the disease.
He being the president. So let me ask you this, then, because you mentioned Fiocruz. That's kind of Brazil's CDC. And just a few weeks ago, the epidemiologist said, today, Brazil is a threat to humanity and an open-air laboratory where impunity and management seems to be the rule. Okay, so there's that, but he's, I think, talking about, and so is the WHO and others, very concerned that your dysfunction in your country is allowing these variants to potentially threaten not just your people, but the rest of the world. And we understand that just recently, two different women at the same time got ill from COVID in Brazil from two different variants. Can you explain how serious and what a challenge that is?
Well, this can happen anywhere. We have the England variant here, the one that you started in England. We have the variant from South Africa, and we have the variant from Manaus. All three of them are in our country now. So the pandemic here is not in a different part of Brazil. The whole country is on the same time, on parallel. They are all in a very high risk of new variants. But as it is Brazil today, if the world doesn't pay attention, tomorrow is going to be Africa, or it's going to be any place in Asia. This is something that the World Health Organization doesn't have the tools to come in and to help. The Pan American Health Association is here in Brazil. I'm going to have a meeting with them tomorrow, try to find ways some measure to bring vaccines and on this international COVAXIN facility to try to make things better. But this is something that is happening here now, and it's going to happen because those variants, they just go. They just move from one country to another. As far as we know, the vaccines are okay with it till now. But the trouble is, if you have a variant that doesn't respect the vaccines, then it's going to be a threat for the whole world, because we are going to go back to zero. So everybody's measuring and trying to do their best to try to avoid this to happen.
Minister Mandetta, as you pointed out, and as we all know, there's an incredibly polarized situation in Brazil, just as there was in the United States. And while President Trump was in office, they called Jair Bolsonaro the Brazilian Trump. And he followed Trump in many of the missteps that Trump did. And Trump was booted out, as you saw, in the last elections, primarily because of his handling or mishandling of COVID. So I guess I put all this because now you see that one of your previous presidents, very, very popular, Luiz Lula da Silva, it looks like he's getting back into the arena. And he had a big rally. And this is what he said about what needs to happen in Brazil about the current president and vaccines. Let's just listen.
There was a president who invented chloroquine, a president who said that those who are scared of COVID are sissies, that COVID was just a little flu, that COVID was something for cowards, that he was a former athlete and that it would not affect him. That is not the role of a president of the republic in a civilized country. Get vaccinated. Get vaccinated because it is one of the things that can free us from COVID.
So Lula, one of the most successful Brazilian politicians and presidents, is saying get vaccinated. You've worked with Bolsonaro for a long time. You served until you were fired in his administration. How much of a political threat is Lula to Bolsonaro? And let's just read you some of the, you know, one of your main polling institutions there say 50% would definitely or probably vote for Lula in an election, 38 for Bolsonaro. Of course, it's more than a year away, but still, how much of a threat is this to Bolsonaro?
Well, it's a threat to Brazil because they're both extremes, one on the left hand and one on the extreme right hand. So they do the same mistakes and they both work, bring, you know, people to really complain on each other. Hate is their fuel. Well, what is being in our society now, people are calling for the midterm between them. So we think that on the right time, we will have a political center, not a center that it doesn't have opinion, but the man that can talk to both sides. I don't know if you put just both of them on an election, I don't know who would win. But for sure, Brazil would lose because they don't have the conditions to heal what Biden's been doing in the United States. Lucky United States that had an election last year. We are going to still have to wait to 2022. So we have a long way to go.
So you say lucky United States and you've called for a middle way. Well, I wonder, does that mean you will run for president on a sort of third way, middle way, as you say? And what would you do right now if the elections were, you know, in a few months, if you had a position of power to change the COVID pandemic dynamic in your country?
Well, I think that nobody can put their names now. We have to put everybody sit on the table. You have 4, 5, 6 names hanging around on the polls. And probably this is going to shrink, and we are going to, in a few months or a couple of months, we're probably going to have a much clearer situation here. The first thing to be done is to restore credibility, restore the health system, and really make different on vaccination. Humanity has been dealing with virus since in the 20th century, we worked very well in many infectious diseases like polio, like measles. And this is our main tool to work against virus. It's not going to come from otherwhere from besides science. So we really have to put an effort there. I think that Brazil will have the vaccines because they started buying now. But for the second semester, probably in September, October, the problem is how are we going to deal with it till then and protect the vaccines so that they can be efficient? This is the right. Now it's our main goal is to save lives and to work better on prevention and vaccinations.
Okay, two quick questions. One, I don't think you told me whether you are considering a run. And two, Bolsonaro, from the beginning, poo-pooed any of these pandemic responses because he said we've got to protect the economy. And now the central bank has said the economy looks like it's surging and it's about to get back to where it was before the crash, so to speak, the COVID crash. What do you say to that?
Well, I cannot say if I'm going to run or not. It depends on what it's going to be, the political agreement for that. We have many names. I can be one of them, sure. But I just repeat, nobody can put their names and say I am till everybody feel comfortable to say that will. And I think that on the second question that you did, I didn't get it. I beg your pardon.
Just the economy was Bolsonaro's reason
for
not putting in place these Yeah, now it looks from the central bank that it's been surging this year.
Well, the economy is going to suffer because it's a false dilemma when you put that first I'm going to take care of the economy and then about the health system. The economy is not going to work with the health system the way it is and with the disease all over the country. So today their inflation is coming back, so they're going to have to put the taxes up, the income taxes, the interest taxes up. We have a deep problem on the economy as the whole world is going to have. We'll need another Marshall Plan for the world after the pandemic goes.
All right. Minister Mandetta, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish the people of your country well. Now, more than a fifth of Americans have now received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, with over 2 million people vaccinated every day. So one of them, cellist Yo-Yo Ma, chose to give something back. He used his 15-minute post-jab observation period for a socially distanced serenade for his fellow vaccine recipients. That was in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Bringing his cello to the vaccine place, getting all those shots into all those arms is a massive logistical challenge. And now one corporation, Salesforce, is using its vast computing resources to help health agencies around the world track vaccinations. And the CEO, Mark Benioff, speaks with our Hari Srinivasan about the many ways COVID-19 is changing the world for business and, of course, for all of us.
Christian, thanks. Mark Benioff, thanks for joining us. An amazing feat of science happened in the last year. We developed a vaccine. There's multiple versions all over the globe. Yet here we are. The last mile seems to be a pretty significant hurdle, how to get that vaccine into people's arms, especially in places like the United States, where it's not one centralized sort of edict, but it is on a county by county or state by state level. And the refrain used to be, there's got to be an app for that. So now, what is the sort of technology community's responsibility and role in trying to make sure we get over this hurdle?
Well, thank you. I mean, that is really, I think, the question that has been on everybody's mind, which is, how are we going to get these shots in arms? And the reality is, this is probably the largest logistical and information technology problem that maybe the world has ever been dealt with. Here where I live in San Francisco, one in every four people already have the vaccine. And that is a case for optimism that we're rapidly moving towards that May 1 date where we can open up the vaccine for everyone. And the vaccine is a miracle of science that we have it. And now we need to make that last mile connection, exactly as you said.
Now, you guys have an initiative called the Vaccine Cloud. What is that?
Well, over the last year, we have had to build a lot of software to help with the pandemic. First, we built contact management. That was a Herculean effort to make sure that we knew where the pandemic was happening and try to rapidly bring solutions to those areas. Now, here we are actually delivering the vaccine. We've built the vaccine cloud. This is an incredible piece of technology that we're deploying to states, nation states, cities that help everything from scheduling your appointment and keeping track of when you had it to any reactions you're having to it, and then all of the reporting that needs to happen according to that schedule. So this is something that we're extremely focused on. It's going very, very well, and we're very optimistic that we'll be able to accomplish our mission here.
Is this something that's free to local governments that are struggling with this?
This is something that we actually have in many situations, commercial relationships with these government customers. It can take on a lot of different cases. In some cases, it is free. In the case, for example, of Gavi that we run, that is the Global Vaccine Initiative, we don't charge them. That is a free initiative. So for all of the developing nations and all the organizations that we're rolling this out to, who could never afford this technology, they would never pay. And I'll just tell you, we run over 50,000 nonprofits and NGOs for free on our service. That's part of who Salesforce is. And we deliver about $1.5 billion of free software every year to those NGOs. This is part of that program.
There's lots of other big tech companies that have some part of this as well. I mean, there's the Microsoft is part of this, Workday is part of this. Well, what makes the vaccine cloud different, or are there just kind of multiple clouds doing what you're talking about?
Well, this isn't the business that we're in. We got here by accident. It turns out our product, which is customer relationship management, that is Customer 360. We're helping companies connect with their customers in new ways, in sales, service, marketing, and commerce. You know, when you buy an Adidas shoe, that's Salesforce. Or when you check into a Marriott hotel, that's Salesforce. So we got here by accident. And what we all of a sudden realized was the technology that we are using for companies like Adidas and Marriott could be used to make it a lot easier to get this vaccine administered. And that's when we went into action.
What have you learned now, a year on into this pandemic, just about leading a company?
That I had to throw everything out the window. I think that this has been a year unlike anything I've ever been in. I'm still at home. All of my 60,000 employees are still at their homes. We do have some offices open around the world. Like I just saw some tremendous videos from our office in Sydney, Australia, where it's remarkably normal. Some of our offices that have reopened, like in Tokyo, Japan, our employees are quite cautious about going back to the office. So we are still in very much the pandemic. We all are ready to go back to the new office environment, whatever that is going to turn out to be. We're not there yet, but we are anxious to get there.
At the beginning of the pandemic, you made a pledge. You said, we're not going to lay anybody off for those first 90 days. And then after that, you had about 1,000 layoffs. And how many of those people were you able to rehire? Because you've also gone out and acquired companies in that time.
We have hired about 5,000 people actually this year so far. But as we hire people, as we make changes to our organization, and we're quite transparent in how we do this, we've had to make slight shifts in our company. And because we have so many employees, those slight shifts, like you mentioned, we actually changed about 1,000 jobs. Many of those people actually ended up in our company. Many of those people we then were able to place in other companies. It turns out our industry is incredibly fast growing, but it's a difficult thing running a company in this environment, but you're still running a company. So you have to be thinking about all your stakeholders, your employees, your customers, your partners, and even your shareholders. And that's a critical part of doing the right thing in this very unusual year.
As you've mentioned, if your 60,000 employees are at home and you've figured out that maybe not all of them need to be at the office at the same time, at the same place, you have scaled back some of your sort of expansion efforts in San Francisco. I mean, you're one of the largest employers in the city there. So I wonder what happens when you multiply that by 1,000 other companies who figured out the same thing? What happens to the downtown real estate, so to speak, of our major cities?
Well, for me, I can just tell you, like, I just came back from my meditation practices, which is how I start my day. And I'm trying to cultivate a beginner's mind. You know, in the beginner's mind, I have every possibility, but in the expert's mind, I have few. And this year, I have found I run a very large company. I have offices and employees all over the world. I am doing large acquisitions. I'm making changes. I'm working on strategic customer success, like you mentioned, the vaccine cloud, other major things as well that I could tell you about. But the thing that I have learned is that everything that I was doing just a year ago is gone. I cannot do what I was doing a year ago, and probably you can't either, that we've all had to change. And so I'm making those changes. And one of the changes that we're making is how we're configuring our real estate. We've learned that when we come back into the office, that we're going to have a different type of real estate footprint. Before, we were spending about 4% of our revenue on real estate. When we come back, we'll probably be spending 2.5% to 3% of our revenue on real estate. That is a tremendous change in how we're architected. Now, we're growing very, very fast, as I mentioned. In fact, we're the fastest growing enterprise software company ever. But regardless, that is a big change.
So when you decide to spend less on office space in downtown, I wonder about kind of the mom and pop places around there that used to feed all of those office workers at lunchtime, right? All of the things that support those central cores. What happens to those businesses?
Well, if we were having a conversation a year ago about San Francisco, the conversation would be a lot about rents out of control, real estate prices out of control, teachers not having the ability to have local housing, police and fire not having the capability to be able to live in the city that they're serving. I mean, we were a city out of balance a year ago. The San Francisco gold rush that we were experiencing, if you will, I mean, this wasn't the first gold rush that we had been through. It was out of control. And everybody knew that. We were trying to put some constraints in. Well, all of a sudden, here comes the pandemic. And everyone is out of their homes, and they've moved, or they're changing, or we're reconfiguring. Our city needed that in San Francisco. We needed to take a big, deep breath. We needed to really think about everything that we need to do to get back now as everybody gets vaccinated. We need a new San Francisco. We need a San Francisco that is rebalanced. And as I said, this is not our first gold rush that we've been through. And if you look at the last gold rush or the other things that San Francisco has been through, our Summer of Love, you know, our huge festivals, you know, for gay rights, you know, as we come out of those major efforts, we have to reconfigure as a city to kind of prepare for the next level of innovation. We're a city that's known for our innovation. It's one of the reasons I love San Francisco. I'm a fourth generation San Franciscan born on Divisadero Street. I understand the city very well. I can tell you one thing. San Francisco is a very innovative, dynamic, but also flexible city. And as it comes back, I have a lot of faith in our ability to come back in a successful way for everybody.
You know, when you think about the type of office culture that you have built over these last 22 years, well, what does that look like in the next two or three? I mean, some of this, I mean, the urgency, for example, some of the banks have said, hey, we want to get people back in because there's a lot of mentorship that happens informally. It's that, or, you know, Tony Hsieh from Zappos used to say it's sort of the creative collisions that happen in the hallway. And he even designed Zappos so that people from different departments would have to bump into each other. What happens when not so many people are bumping into each other, whether it's at Salesforce or at thousands of the other companies that you have visibility into?
Well, you are 100% right. You know, Tony, may his memory be for a blessing. This idea that we are bumping into each other, or that we need interaction with each other, or we need to get together as groups to innovate, this is built into our DNA as human beings. So that has to be part of the answer. Even now, I'm bringing small groups of our executives, employees together through the magic of vaccines, but also through the magic of PCR testing and other capabilities. We are restarting how we collaborate in person. And what I anticipate is that, and if we start, as I mentioned, from a beginner's mind, we're going to be able to create our company in an entirely new way. And I hope that we will take everything we learned from the past and then apply it to what can be, not what was. And that's what I'm optimistic about every single day.
I know you made an enormous acquisition of Slack at the end of the year. It's an office productivity software for people who don't use it. But you've also made some other big ones. I think just kind of a general company question, how do you make sure that these things all work together and serve your clients? I mean, sometimes the integration of these different pieces seem to be the hardest parts of these giant acquisitions that we hear about. And then 3 or 4 years we hear later, okay, well, that was just kind of written off. That didn't really work. You know, and shareholders are upset about it.
Well, for mentioning that, that is like a major part of running a software company. You know, innovation comes from everywhere. You know that. And if you're the CEO of a technology company, and if you think innovation is only happening in your, you know, virtual four walls, you're making a radical mistake. Innovation is happening anywhere. And that means that you may want to bring innovation that's not in your company into your company. We've acquired more than 60 companies, for example. And it's a learned skill. Making those companies successful, bringing them together, bringing cultures together, bringing leaders together, it's not perfect. It's not going to work every single time, but you have to do it. And that's one of the reasons why Salesforce is one of the fastest growing enterprise software companies ever. The reason why is because we value innovation, much like how we value trust, or we value customer success, or we even value quality. These are our four core values. And for me, I'm talking to people every single day and I'm hearing all these new ideas. And every now and then I'm like, oh, wow, that's an idea that should be inside Salesforce. And I'm going to make sure that that is going to happen. And then my job is to make sure that's successful for our customers.
Do you think that innovation has been stymied by sort of increased concentrations of power? And I say that because there is now a little bit more of an interest, at least in the Biden administration, looking at more antitrust kind of actions that the government could be taking across the spectrum, especially focused on some big social media platforms.
It's the history of our industry. If you look back at from when our industry first started, we've seen these waves of technology and companies and innovation, exactly like you said, can stall. And it can stall if there is too much aggregation of power or control in any one particular company or segment. So it is up to the government to regulate correctly. You're right. I've actually called for increased regulation in many parts of our industry, including in social media. We need, the government has a critical role to play, and it's important that they play that role.
One of the things you have also famously called for is that the rich should pay more taxes. And we saw this year a staggering escalation of inequality in the United States, where literally millions of people found themselves out of work. The wealthiest 100 Americans probably made somewhere close to $600 billion increase in their own wealth. And I'm wondering whether you would be in support of the propositions that are in Congress now, basically a wealth tax that for someone like you might cost you up to 3%.
Well, I'm always looking at taxes and how do we use revenue streams to support those who have the least. Now, one of our core values I just mentioned is equality. One of the values, the opposite of that, is inequality. So in San Francisco, we have a tremendous homeless problem. And so I've advocated now for quite a few years that the top 50 companies each pay a very, very small part of their revenue for the opportunity to, you know, work in the greatest city in the world, but also take care of the homeless. We passed that tax. It got passed by the Supreme Court. I think that's an example of what you're saying, where those who have the most can always help the least. And this is very important, and we have to make those connections.
What keeps you motivated right now to keep this day job? I mean, look, it can't be money anymore. You have enough of that, right? You're sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Most of those things are satisfied. I mean, I read in the press that you're grooming your COO to take over for you. So my question is kind of, how is it true? And two, how long do you want to keep this day job if it's not true?
Well, as I mentioned to you before, this has been a year where I've been very grateful to be the CEO of Salesforce. I've been able to do a lot of good with my business. You know, I really strongly believe that business is the greatest platform for change, that these businesses properly architected with all their stakeholders, that is, as I mentioned, their employees, their customers, their partners, well, that we can really do good in the world. And I talk to many CEOs who are scaled companies now, like we're a scaled company. So when I talk to those CEOs, I tell them exactly that this is a great opportunity, an opportunity for them to take their companies, their titles, their positions of power as CEOs, do something good with it. You know, business is the greatest platform for change, and we can use our businesses to make the world better.
So does that mean that you have to stay the CEO of Salesforce to do that good?
Well, I am right now, so that's where I am.
All right. I can see I'm not getting an answer from you on this, but Mark Benioff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And I hope we're about to see everything reopen and all of us get back to the beautiful lives.
Now, while many countries talk about being on a war footing to combat COVID, 10 years ago today, the actual war in Syria erupted. While the whole world stood by and watched, Syria was overrun by extreme Islamic terrorists and foreign powers backing the Syrian dictator Bashar Assad. Half a million people have been killed and more than 6 million have fled in those years. Violence specifically targeted against journalists made Syria very difficult to cover. But we are going to talk now to two filmmakers who've captured the suffering there. Waad al-Khatib's documentary For Summer shows us what it's like to live under siege and the relentless bombing of Aleppo. It was nominated for an Oscar last year. Now, while Gianfranco Rossi's opus Notturno captures the persistence of life amid the ruins and indeed the aftermath. And they are both joining me now. Gianfranco Rossi and Waad al-Khatib, welcome to the program. Can I just start with you, Waad, because you were there while the war was going on and you provided the world with a pretty rare and very intimate glimpse of what it was like for you, for your young daughter, for your community, for your husband. Take us back to that time and the suffering there that continues today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Beth. And yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, exactly, we were sitting at home, trying to know what's happening in Syria. There was like small protests started like in Daraa city, others one in Damascus. And we were just like watching without real news, because the regime was shutting down all the channels, all the like the truth of what's happening. And during this 10 years, we've like learned so much about weapons and attacks. And we saw the violence from minute one of the revolution, when the regime started to shut us like directly when we were protesting, and then start like to shell and bomb whole areas and whole neighborhoods with cities. Later on with chemical weapon, with sieging like cities, with attacking hospitals, schools, and everything you can see, like a very small part in Fort Sama. Like through this 10 years, we've never expected that the whole world will stay watching as they are until now. And yeah, I mean, it's war, but it started as a revolution, as a call for dignity, for freedom, for better life for us and for our children.
And it's still, as you say, so unresolved. And it's in a different way. War is continuing against the people there economically and many, many other different ways. I want to ask you, Gianfranco Rossi, because Notturno is a very, very different look at Syria. And I know that you spent some 3 years, and it is a remarkable outsider's view of what's going on. It's almost like you plonk your camera down and you observe. There's no narration. There's no you in it, so to speak. What inspired you to take that route to telling this story?
Well, you know, we talked 4 years ago when I did Fire at Sea. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly the same time. At the time, I was nominated for the Oscar. And tonight, I know I'm not nominated for the Oscar. We arrived at the short list, and then we didn't make the next step. And at the time, that film was extremely political film. It was a time when Lampedusa, this little island in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, became the doors of Europe. You know, people were escaping from Syria, from Iraq, from Lebanon, and arriving to Lampedusa, this little island where I spent 3 years to make that film. And then my next step was as an outsider, as you say, because this is like, you know, I can feel like her incredible being there. And I am an outsider. And being an outsider for me, it took me 3 years. It took me 3 years to make a film that somehow I think is a parable that tells the tragedy of destiny and somehow the betrayal of history. And when I was there, I wanted to somehow narrate the borders of, at that time when I started the film 4 years ago, that was 4 years ago, the ISIS state was collapsing. And, you know, that border that was an invisible border, because you never know where the border is between, of course, historical, we know where the border is. The border started in 1916 and created a total disaster. But when you're there, falling war, falling things that happen there, falling collapse of the ISIS, the border becomes an invisible margin and becomes a stratification because of history
and becomes the margin where story is and the history is. So for me, that border, that was somehow a sense of division, a sense of division between countries, it became like where I met my 6-8 stories that I did in these 3 years, in these 6 years. So I wanted to give the voice to the people, and I know how painful it is. You know, Lampedusa is a tiny island. 4,000 people live there, and these maps are huge. You know, it's like huge. History is going on maps, and how I can relate the pain in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria, and things, and how I can go into these borders, and just by giving the voice to the people I met. This was a journey for me,
right.
And I wanted to give voice to these people I met.
It was an amazing journey, and the voice you gave was actually amazing. And I'm going to get to that in a minute, because both you and Wired, in fact, a big element of your films, in different ways completely, is about children as well. So Wired, obviously, your film is called For Summer, your firstborn child, born under siege, born in the most dangerous time possible in the war in Syria. I want to play a little clip because it's so incredibly poignant, and it basically tells the whole story.
Summer. 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 عملت هالفيلم مشانك. بدي اياك تفهم شو اللي كنا عم نقاتل مشانه. أصو بيقدر بكثير اليوم سما أنا بعرف إنك عم تفهم شو عم بصير.
So Wired, it's about the children, it's about the generation, it's about the doctors. Your husband was an emergency doctor there. It's about ordinary life, your marriage, and so much about the fear of the younger generation. You made, I think, a conscious decision to tell the story through those human, individual, ordinary people's eyes, as opposed to just soldiers and just the rebels and just the different sides.
Yeah, I mean, when I was still in Syria, and I saw that, like, how people look at us, like, in Syria, how the story is being also, like, delivered out. Like, people either look at us that, like, heroes and people who are, like doing things like literally like very, very kind of like big things, or they look at us as victims, people who lost everything, who they don't have kind of voice, they don't can say like no or yes for what they are doing. But then like at the end, we are just normal people. We are human beings as anyone else in this world. We have dreams, we have life, we feel like we fall in love, we get married, we have children, we have same decisions any like other mom in the whole world like should take and can take. And in this position, I feel that like, you know, I'm living with these people. I having the whole image about how we want people to know about us, not just like what people can see in the news or they can see like in other films. So I just wanted to tell the whole world what we've been through and what we faced. Mm-hmm. And especially like at that time after we lost Aleppo, we were firstly displaced out of Syria, and although that was like a huge thing for us and we were very grateful that we were alive, but we weren't happy. We didn't want to leave, although we know like it's very risky and very dangerous. And I just wanted like to tell the whole world about very simple like message. We wanted to stay in our country. We wanted a peaceful life. We wanted like freedom, dignity as anyone else. And like that's what happened when we stood for our rights and for the Syrian people rights.
And just to remind, you know, millions of people have fled, 500,000 people were killed. I mean, it's a real catastrophe. And Gianfranco, from your perspective, you saw some of these children who were suffering, obviously, from the kind of PTSD that Wired you know, talks about, and the just the terrible trauma that this whole nation, including the children, went through for now 10 years. I want to play a rather lengthy clip, and it just speaks to this, you know, this generational catastrophe there. Let's just play it.
Εγώ στη βάση αν δύο χρόνια μου πω, οκ.
Τα περιφερμάνε τα σάτι, θα μου χάνε άσχον κάτι, χαρκά μου ραβίνα ατσιά, χαρκά μου στιγνά μου σπρσιά, σγκέρμι, δάσα, χάνε, ερωάν, πατυράντε, θα μου κοτσιά ουτάντε, χαρκά του κουστινού, ο μαμάτα, θα μου εμφιτζάρτε.
Τώρα βγει εκεί, βα.
Ας, ας ραβεί με εκεί.
Του ελκύω, είπουι.
Α.
Ούτε αβεδίτε με τσοβέτ χωτσό ομέρα.
Α.
Τσόγω πουν, βάση γον και έτσι.
Βε χάμνα το χωτσό. Καλά και.
Ούνα φεσό χω χέλκεσο.
Πλά.
Είτε, κεσό. Πλά. Κίσο. Πίνα χώρο.
These are really brilliant scenes, Gianfranco, and to see children going through that kind of trauma and then, you know, being having their teacher be their therapist. What did you think when you went in? And there's many other of those children who you profiled as well.
You know, I have to say that this is, for me, the most painful moment. I spent there 3 years, and it's nothing, you know, it's nothing 3 years in the life of someone, and I'm an outsider. And yet be in this Yazidi community that had been depraved from the mother were like sex slave. When I went there, I wanted to somehow portray the story of a mother that they were like somehow... I met a few mothers that survived this enormous trauma of being took out and everything was breaking down there. And it for me was impossible to put this in the film. There is a moment I was able to do that with a phone call. And the phone call is a mother that lost her daughter. And the daughter is being still now, I know, because I have contact with her, still in the hands of ISIS. And there is this whole phone call, and I encountered this phone. And then 3 years later, in my journey, I encountered the mother. She was living in Germany. And this is just to say how difficult it is to make a film like that, you know, how that's why I decided to cancel all the border. Because the border, for me, were a limitation. The pain of a mother in Kurdistan, the pain of a mother in Iraq, the pain of a mother in Lebanon, the pain of a kid was the same. So I did something extremely, on the editing, challenging and extremely harsh. I delete these borders and I let just my experience of meeting the people I met in these 3 years, becoming a whole story, becoming something else, becoming a moment of awareness of what is the pain. And the pain, it's enormous there. You know, like this mother I met on the phone call there, and these kids I met without father and mother anymore. And what those kids say is, it's so huge. I could make a film of 10 hours there. And yet I choose to just go on the synthesis of life to create something that is universal.
We could talk forever about this. It's a brilliant, brilliant film. And so, of course, was yours, Wad, For Sama. Brilliant films about Syria that many journalists were not able to cover because they couldn't really get in. Thank you both very, very much for being with us on this 10th anniversary. Now, just to note that during the 1990s, we journalists did cover the Bosnia War intensively. The main Bosnian Serb commanders were convicted of genocide after the massacre at Srebrenica. And now, a young Bosnian filmmaker, Jasmila Zbanić, is being recognized by the Oscars for her film, the gripping tale about the war, Quo Vadis Aida. It was nominated today for Best International Feature Film, keeping history, memory, and truth alive. And finally, more on the Oscars and sticking with the awards season, women and people of color lead the notable names from last night's Grammys and today's Oscar nominations. Viola Davis became the most nominated black actress in Oscar history with her nod for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Chadwick Boseman received a posthumous nomination for Best Actor in that film. And for the first time, two women were recognized for Best Director, Nomadland's Chloe Zhao and Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman. Meanwhile, it was ladies' night at the Grammys too. Women scored the top four prizes, including Taylor Swift, earning Album of the Year for Folklore. And with her 28th trophy, Beyoncé is now the most decorated woman in Grammy history. Such good news, and that's it for now. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.